Tech is a bi-weekly podcast exploring the intersections of technology and ministry. It is part of the podcast network sponsored by Wells, the Wisconsin Evangelical Lutheran Synod. Our show today is hosted by Martin Spriggs and Sally Draper. Welcome to Wells Tech, everybody. This is episode 739, and we're recording it on December 4th, 2024. My name is Martin Spriggs, and you've joined a show about technology and ministry and where those two intersect. And joining me as usual, Sally Draper. Hello, Sally.
Hi, Martin. Happy to be joining you. We've made it through Thanksgiving, Black Friday, and Cyber Monday. Here we are on the other side of all
and
of giving that.
Tuesday, and in December. I got a lot of Giving Tuesday emails yesterday.
That's true. Very true.
So I don't know if today is Wells Tech Day. I don't know if it's got another name, but for us, it's Wells Tech Day.
Take a rest from all the marketing, hopefully.
Right, exactly. So we plug along, and we are kind of slowing down, taking a little bit off the accelerator as we come into the end of the year, as we normally do next week or next time we have a show. We'll do an interview and we'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. But the show we decided to put together today is actually a show that, or a topic that is useful any time of the year, but it is something that I think is on the minds of anybody who manages communications, certainly in a congregation or school, and that's digital forms. We've talked about this off and on, and the landscape kind of changes. There's other tools out there. But we thought we'd talk about best practices. Sally, you were involved in putting together a rather lengthy form recently, and you deal with forms all the time as we're building things that collect information. But I'd say almost everybody listening has put together some kind of form at some point, whether digital or otherwise. And there's just some good ways to do it and some bad ways to do it. So we figured let's talk through it and hopefully we can gain some insights from each other and maybe share some best practices as you're putting together forms, whether that be for volunteers or joining a conference or whatever that may be. We'll just kind of go from top to bottom. How does that sound?
Sounds great. Actually, my congregation is in the middle of collecting data with a form. So the timing of this is just perfect. They're actually doing a little bit of a worship survey, just things you like about the way we worship, what types of music do you enjoy, because we generally bring in a lot of variety in the types of music that we have in our worship services. And then they're doing a favorite hymns kind of, you know, let's open it up and get everybody's ideas on favorite hymns. We're going to have a hymn festival on that Sunday between Christmas and New Year's. And they also obviously want to work it into future worship planning as well. So a really good use of a form. And so obviously they had some goals. And I think that's the best place to start when you're designing a form is kind of at the end. What is it that you want to accomplish? What is it that you need to know? What kind of data do you need to work with once you're done collecting the responses? You know, starting there with your planning can really drive and guide how the form design works. So, you know, maybe you need to ask some questions that send people down one path or another, something that we call branching when we talk about forms. Or perhaps you need a certain type of question, one that has, you know, a scale of responses or stars or something like that for people to vote on how well they like something. So again, just kind of having that vision of the end of the road really can do a lot of the work of putting the form together.
Mm-hmm. And oftentimes the person building the form isn't the person who is has the in-depth knowledge of or the most vested interest in getting the data. So it's helpful if you're the form designer because you're the resident, techie or whatever, spend some time with the people who are really interested in the data and say, well, what are you going to do with this data? What are, like you mentioned, what are the objectives? What are you trying to get out of this? And sometimes you have to tease that out of them and help them think through, what's a priority here? And it is important to prioritize data because you can't ask and shouldn't ask everything. There are things that are going to limit your ability to get information out of those people that you're asking. And one of those is form length. If it's a 30 question form, don't expect as good a return as a 5 question form. So if you can only build a 5 question form, what are those 5 pieces of information that you absolutely have to have? And start and go from there. And then you can deal with things like form branching and those kinds of things where people are, you've got them and you feel that they're interested and you can maybe, branch them off into some more, some rabbit holes and get a little bit more specific information.
Yeah. One thing they did in our congregation, Martin, which has nothing to do with the techie side of things, was they actually published the questions that are on the form. So they said, it's going to take you about 5 minutes to complete, and here are the 5 questions that we're asking you. Maybe that took some of the mystery out of the
Right.
process, like just to get them to click it, they know what they're going to see. They're not going to be thrown any curveballs. They can be prepared with their answers before they even start. So, again, that kind of goes into the planning phase, that how are we going to get people to answer this, and who are we going to, reach out to for answers and things like that. All of that really should be done on the front end of things so that you have that clear picture of where you're going with the effort.
Yeah. And maybe, and we'll talk about this maybe a little bit later too, but when you begin to kind of test the form, might not be a bad idea to trot out some of those questions even before it's in a digital form to potential form fillers. Take a look at these questions. What do you think? How would you react if you received this and a request to fill out this form? So that's a good use of in that planning and early stages development. So you're not wasting a lot of time. And having to redo a lot of things. So there is this concept in development called iterative design. So maybe start small and build and do some tests and see what kind of feedback you get and then move on from there. So you're kind of slowly building this thing up. And that would suggest planning is super important that you don't just sit down one night and expect the form to be launched the following morning and you've got all your ducks in a row. It should take some time. Talk to people, do a run up to it rather than a quick sprint. So we talked about form logic and branching, and all the online forms now have some kind of capabilities like that. And that's helpful from a technology perspective where you don't have to necessarily overwhelm your audience with, the 30 questions. You can hide some of those based on previous responses. And some of those questions you don't even ask if they answer one way or another. So the form becomes a little bit smarter. And another thing that a lot of the forms do is give you progress indicators. How far along am I? Especially if it's a longer form, give them an idea of how much they have to go or how long it might take them to fill out the form. You may even say that at the top. This shouldn't take you any longer than 5 minutes, something like that. So there's tools and even the kind of the go-tos, which we'll talk about in a minute, like Google Forms and whatever, they kind of give you an idea of how long this might take, to fill out. So that's helpful.
Right. Do some planning about required versus not required or verified fields, like putting in things if you're expecting an email address, that you get an email address, a valid email address and response, or you're expecting a number. If someone puts in a letter, it won't allow that or whatever. Think through what are your key points, and sometimes all the fields have to be required, but
Yep.
if they don't, give them some leeway as the answerers to skip over things if they don't feel like they have responses in certain areas. So definitely think through those kind of things. Another important thing to think through, and I don't know the proper term, I'm not the greatest English person, I'm a math person, but kind of the voice you're asking the questions in and keeping it consistent
The
throughout
tone is,
what
yeah.
person, what in what way you're asking the question. And again, the people planning and designing may not ask the questions in the best format or consistently in their original plans. So you as the form designer might need to tweak some things to keep things very consistent throughout.
Yeah, this might be a place where AI can help you. I think AI might be good at analyzing the question and measuring or gauging the tone and temperament, and maybe suggesting shortened versions or more direct questions. Don't use passive voice, those kinds of things. Field design is super important. You're kind of getting at that. You have to kind of determine what kind of question. Is it a true false? Is it a yes, no? Is it a multiple choice? It might depend on what you're going to do with the data too, don't you think? Because if you want to measure the data or put together charts, graphs, trends, free-formed responses aren't overly helpful in that regard. So you're not going to really analyze or be able to analyze the data as well if you're asking just kind of random questions that can have random answers. So if you really want to limit the response, then you have to think about what kind of field design you're going to make. Maybe that would be a drop down or multiple choice or something like that. If you're looking for just thoughts, then obviously you create a box and you say, write whatever you want. You want to still give them some guidance on what you want in the box, but that may dictate what how you design and develop the form too.
Oftentimes there's extra fields that are available to you, like a sub question
Right.
area or some text in the box that displays as they start to answer the question. They get some guidance there. So different platforms provide it in different ways, but there are definitely ways to bake in some of that helpful content that's just kind of next level for people that are trying to understand better
Yeah.
how to respond.
They're taking the time to fill it out, so you want to be mindful of
Supportive.
that and be sensitive to that. But the worst thing you can do is create a form and ask people to fill it out, and then the data that you get back isn't helpful to you. So you want to help yourself, help them help you. So that is all into that field design and validation. And if you need a phone number, make sure that if you're in an area where you've got multiple area codes, make sure you ask for area code. People don't always put that in, or those kinds of things, so that you can grab all the data that you need. Date of birth, do you need year? Those kinds of things. So,
Oh, mentioning date of birth, that's a potential privacy concern
it
there,
is.
Martin.
Yes.
So, yeah, you have to be sensitive to the kind of questions you're asking and how you handle the data that you receive. Maybe you're in some kind of, affiliate organization and you're gathering all this data and then it just sits in Google Drive for years and years and years. Well, you should really be cognizant of security around things that you gather and making sure that you're not the weak link that divulges some of that information to those out there who would love to put their hands on it.
Right. So since we're talking about privacy and security, one thing that we pay a lot of attention to here at the Senate is making sure that people know what we're going to do with your data. So it's important to think through that and limit the data collection only to that information that's absolutely necessary. If you're going to use it for other purposes, that's okay, just as long as you're telling them, yeah, I'm going to use this to, sign you up for our newsletter or do this or that with the data, or follow up at this event next year. We may market it to you. That kind of stuff is important to be upfront with and make sure that, as you all should, have a privacy policy right on your website that people are aware of, and you link to that on your form as well. We're not going to sell your data, that kind of stuff. People are very sensitive to that, and it's important to be upfront with that.
Definitely. Kind of the icing on the cake once they press submit is that they know you received what you're sending what they are sending to you. And so a confirmation screen, and oftentimes the form builders will include that automatically, but you can have control over that. You can point them to a page on your website if that's your desire or whatever it is. So, pay attention to that wrap up. If they're going to get an email in response, what kind of content is going to be in that email? And oftentimes you can control that as well. So, just be sure that you've finished the process all the way through to confirmation.
So, Sally, before we jump off this topic, let's talk a little bit about some of the tools that are out there because there's a ton of them. Some of them are what I would call standalone form builders, and others are more integrated into other tools that you may already be using. One that probably is at the top of most people's list is Google Forms, and that's something that both you and I are pretty familiar with. Google Forms, I think, in its early stages was very basic, didn't do a lot, but now it can do a lot. Plus, you have a lot of different plugins you can apply to these things and slice and dice the data. And just a pretty cool ecosystem for gathering data is Google Forms. It's pretty user-friendly, I think. Lots of YouTube videos out there that show you how to do all kinds of the things that you might need, and there's all kinds of templates out there. So Google Forms, if especially if you're in the Google ecosystem, with Google Sheets and such, how you're collecting that data is maybe a first choice for a lot of people.
Yeah, this one I have a lot of experience with, especially around the fall period of the year, because I actually do the form for the Minnesota District Lutheran Teachers Conference, and we use Google Forms to collect that data. They pay separately. That's not a credit card or anything like that.
Right.
That's not a capability of Google Forms at this time, but it does offer plugins even after the fact. So, most of these forms tools write to a spreadsheet, the data that's collected, and that's the case with Google Forms. It writes to a Google Sheet. And then in Google Sheets, in this particular case, I have a plugin on the sheet that says when there's a new form submitted, run a program and send them a confirmation email from the Google
There
Sheet
you
that
go.
includes a PDF of their registration information. So you're right, there are just many different plugins and things that you can add on that can make your job pretty simple, actually.
One kind of newer form tool that you just recently worked with, Sally, Microsoft Forms. If you're in that Microsoft ecosystem, might make sense to use a Microsoft form. What are your thoughts on its capabilities?
It's very comparable to Google Forms, which is kind of where I grew up. And so it was an easy transition to use Microsoft Forms. Some things are in different places, some things you can control, some things you can't. But writes to an Excel spreadsheet on your OneDrive instead of a Google Sheet. But for the most part, they're almost side by side, exactly the same.
And I
So
think you can use
just
Microsoft Forms for free as well. There's a free version as well as a paid for version.
I believe
Then there's a
so.
bunch of others that we've talked about, I think, in previous shows. JotForms is, I think, a popular one out there. Typeform. If you're in the WordPress ecosystem, and that's often where you are sending your people is to your website. WordPress is the most popular content management system. There are plugins for WordPress that allow forms generation,
Many.
WP forms, or the one we use at the Synod level is Gravity Forms. Very robust tool that does, it's probably Google Forms on steroids. If you're talking about what the capabilities are with encryption, and you can plug in things that will take funds, will take payments, those kinds of things,
Also,
all
you can
kinds of
do
things.
layout like fields side by side instead of just the straight top to bottom thing. We should probably make a plug too that all of these are very mobile friendly these days. So even if you do the layout and fields are side by side, it'll stretch them out for you if it's on a tiny phone screen or whatever.
And then I mentioned that there's another category, integrated solutions, and we won't go through those because that was really dependent on maybe the CRM that you're using or other tools that you have at your disposal. But you may want to check out what is available in those tools that you use. As many of them do have built-in form builders that integrate nicely with maybe a content system or a member database system, those kinds of things. So all there for you. So that's kind of our take, at least, on forms design. We didn't get into a lot of the technical stuff, but I think the power in forms is kind of the brain power you put into it, how you're not just using the tool, but how you think through what the user is going to do and their experience and how you're getting that data out. So always a good thing to keep in mind as you're trying to interact with your users.
Good stuff.
All right. Sally, should we move on to our ministry resource for this week?
I think it's that time. I'm going to do a quick screen share. And as always, we'll have links to all these things in the show notes at wellstech.wells.net. But we wanted to point you to some resources available from Congregational Services around Wells Youth Night. It's basically a series of events where they're providing content for you to present youth activities, kind of like a mini youth conference, maybe in your
Yeah, a
area. So
youth
you
rally of
certainly probably
sorts. Yeah.
could use it with an individual youth group, but the idea is to bring together a group of people in the area so that you'd have these events. And they actually have, just like the church here, they have a 3-year series out here, moving into year 3, 2024-25, with different activities and resources available. There's a media kit for promoting, so all kinds of different social media imagery and things like that. There's even an hour-long Q&A type webinar that walks you through the different resources that are available for Wells Youth Night. So as you are preparing for youth ministries in your area, they've got, Bible studies and small group discussions, fun things to do, games, all kinds of things that you can use with your youth group for these youth nights. So we'll definitely link to it in the show notes, as I said.
Great, great ministry resource. Another great ministry resource is Pastor Don Daberstein himself, who is one of our co-workers and in charge of discipleship at the Center for Mission and Ministry, and the person behind some of these resources. So he would be a great person to talk to see what knowledge and experience and some suggestions he might have for you as well. So, here to serve. Sally, let's move on to our picks of the week. What did you have this week?
Well, this week I wanted to promote something from my friend Matt Miller. If you've listened very long, you know that I'm a fan of Ditch That Textbook. Matt is the author of that book and several others. I think we did Teach Tech Like a Pirate as one of our book discussions a few years ago from Matt Miller. One thing that Matt does each year over the Christmas holidays, when teachers traditionally have a bit of a break from the classroom, is he offers something called a digital Ditch That Textbook Summit. It's a free event, and you can find out more at ditchsummit.com. This year, it's going to be happening from December 16th to January 10th. And so each year, he recruits a group of speakers, and they record a session and provide some resources around it. And you can watch those sections, asynchronously, whenever's convenient for you, in your pajamas, on the couch, with the fireplace going, whatever the scenario, over that holiday time. But when January 10th gets here, he turns it all off and you can't access it anymore. Included is all of the past sessions from the previous 8 years. This is actually the 9th year that Matt's organized this. And so you get like over 100 different professional development type videos that you can tune into, whatever your area of interest are. And this year, I just got a little bit of insider insight that isn't actually out there on the website yet, but there are going to be 4 sessions based on artificial intelligence. And I'll give you a little rundown of that. He's going to have one on how to ace student AI literacy. And ACE is basically kind of a framework that he and Holly Clark have come up with, where they break down and give practical tips on what students should know and be able to do with AI to succeed and thrive in the future. So that should be really interesting. Another one is Cautious Steps Toward AI Implementation in EDU. Cautious Steps, and this is from the authors, I should say, of a book called The Promises and Perils of AI in Education. That's one we've talked about a little bit, Martin. And Ken Shelton and Deb Lanier are combining their efforts and talking about being cautious with the realities of AI. So that one's probably going to be really interesting. Then there's a student-led panel where the students are kind of giving their perspective on the uses of AI and what they think about it and expect from it. And then finally, it wraps up with how will you spend the time that AI saves you? Someone that's actually delved in and given a lot of thought to all that time we're going to save because of AI. So that sounds like a very interesting conversation as well. So I've signed up. It's free. And you'll just get notices throughout as these different presentations are rolled out. And those four are only the AI based presentations that are new this year. There are other AI presentations from past years, and there's a ton of other topics that are covered as well. So, what's there to lose? It's a free summit. You may just find one that you're interested in, but all the better if you do. The reason that I have this insider AI knowledge, you might ask, is because I joined a group of mats called AI for Admins, and I'm really impressed with the content that's coming out of that group. It's actually open to anyone. He encourages administrators and those policymaker types, especially, to be in the group, but certainly anyone can join and read along and be a part of the content that's being shared there. And again, it's free as well. But Matt actually set this one up with its own kind of community. He's got a teachable website that he set up, and there's a very robust discussion group that's part of this AI for Admins. And people are sharing all kinds of stuff, including, I'll do a quick screen share. I just stumbled across this morning as I was looking at this, someone who shared their teacher AI tools. And this is a really long Google slide where they've put together all different resources. They've vetted them regarding age limitations and pricing and all kinds of things for each individual resource. Who can use them, who shouldn't use them, whether you have to be 13 or older, whatever it may be. And this goes on for quite a while, lesson plan assistance, and many other things that are included. So I'll share a link just because I think this is an amazing resource. And I almost guarantee you that you're going to find some new things in this that you weren't aware of before you saw it because it's really up to date. This person put it together for their teachers for this school year. And lots of good stuff there. So that's just one of the things I found in the AI for Admins group that Matt runs. So I'll have a link to that in the show notes as well.
That's awesome. And that was a free resource. You don't need to be join anything or
No,
put on a list.
just your email. You
Yeah, that
just,
slide deck
yeah.
looked awesome. Yeah. All right, good pick. Thanks, Sally. My pick of the week. And I did a quick search on wellstech.wells.net because I thought, sure, I must have picked this at some point in the past. But no, iFixit is something that you maybe hear about once in a while because they kind of do these teardowns of all the newest gadgets and say how fixable it is. But one thing that they also do is they provide tool sets, some for very specific purposes, like taking your laptop apart, others for more generic purposes, like sets of screwdrivers and little tips for different kinds of screws that you might run across in technology repair. I would say anybody who repairs PCs or needs to get inside and deal with these little tiny, very weird type screws sometimes, this is the thing for you. So I have one of these. I've had it for a number of years, and the one that Sally's showing, I've really got it and show it in real person here. But it's a nice setup where it's a plastic case, magnetic closing, and kind of a, I don't know what this material is, but it's they cut out a little holes in it where everything has its place. So you can immediately tell where the tool came from and where it needs to go back to. So that's one of the nicest parts about this. But it has all kinds of tips for different kinds of screws, stars and hexes and squares and slotted or Phillips, those kinds of things. It has some sockets in here. It even has a tool that allows you to bend around corners, so you attach this to the screwdriver itself, and it'll rotate the device into tight spots. Just nice quality tools as well. And you don't have to necessarily just use this on tech devices, although it comes in super handy for that, and that's one of the reasons that I got it. But you can use it on things like tightening up the screws in your glasses or different things, anything that has a small screw or kind of an odd head size. These iFixit tool sets are just kind of nice to have around, and of high quality. Like I said, I've had this for years and it looks brand new yet. And I have found a bunch of uses for it. So I thought, hey, this is a good pick. Got the tech angle to it, of course, but I think it has a lot of different uses. And if you go to the iFixit site, they have all kinds of tool sets or static mats, those kinds of things that people might use, especially if they're working on technology. So take a look at their site and their store. They've got different screwdrivers, things to pry things open, soldering tools, measuring tools, all kinds of good stuff. So can't recommend it enough. That's iFixit, iFixit.com, and then take a look at what's on their site.
That's great. Great timing for those of us who might be looking for Christmas presents. I noticed it had a
Yeah,
little
the sweet spot. Yeah, the one that I got is like $30, kind of a nice sweet spot maybe for Christmas.
And the magnetic lid could serve as a kind of a bowl to put the all those tiny screws in that always end up rolling off the table when I do that kind of stuff. So
Yeah, I was wondering if does Kevin have one of these kits?
I don't know, but he might very soon. He just actually took apart both of our personal laptops and upgraded them to 64 gig of RAM. And it was quite an undertaking to dig around in the laptops, but I
That's
think
exactly
YouTube
what these
teaches
are
you that
for.
as well. You can learn anything on YouTube.
For sure, for sure. That's our picks of the week. Let's go to community news and feedback.
Sure.
I
Starting
can do the
with a
first one, Sal, if
question.
you like. I got a message, I think through LinkedIn, from a former college, not exactly a classmate, but was in school at the same time, Tom Bernthal. He had a quick question. He said, our elders are looking for streamlining attendance tracking. We use Church 360 from Concordia. I can currently manually enter attendance from three services and approximately 700 attendees using connection cards they've filled out and then using memory on some people. We are exploring if there are any automated methods you know that other congregations are using. And I'm assuming what he means is automating that entry into Church 360. Does entering 700 attendees, that can be some time consuming stuff. So I think just tips and tricks for how to get that into Church 360 or just kind of tracking attendance in general, we would welcome those tips. Go to our WellsTech page, wellstech.wells.net, and leave a comment there on this show or leave us a voicemail or send us an email, wellstech@wells.net, if you've got an answer for Tom.
Well, I have a tiny partial answer. It really doesn't help a lot, but we use connection cards as well. And what we refer to as a connection card is a maybe a quarter sheet of paper that has,
Like an
a place
index
for people
card.
to sign their names and address, and if they're a guest or member, and whether they took communion on the back, we have a place for a prayer request and other things. And that's a paper thing that goes in our bulletin each week. But we have a digital version, actually a Google form that has the same questions on it. And so there's a QR code on the paper form that you can scan the QR code and answer digitally. So that might offset, you might even encourage people, would really love it if you gave the digital a try. That would save us some data entry time and stuff, and maybe kind of train your congregation to go that route where they're filling it out in a form and it's in spreadsheet format then for you to import into whatever system you'd need it in. So,
Awesome. Maybe we can share that form with the kids here.
sure.
All right. What else do we have in community news and feedback, Sally?
Well, I made a note. I was reading the Kim Komando. She does a weekday email and it's just packed with all kinds of stuff. And one thing she mentioned, and I think probably is top of mind for many of us, but worth reinforcing, was just being aware of Christmas scams. And you know they're out there because this is a time of money when people are a little time of year when people are a little freer with their money as they're shopping and trying to find good deals, trying to capitalize on a sale in a quick moment. And that's exactly what the cyber criminals want you to do, to think that there's an urgency about what you need to do. So definitely, keep those spidey senses engaged and be aware of things. Don't go to, bad websites that look like or spoof a real website or whatever. Go directly to it instead of using links that might show up magically in your email and all that just plethora of emails that we've received in terms of marketing at this time of year. One that Kim mentioned specifically was something kind of non-techie, and that one somewhat surprised me, but she said that porch pirates are a huge thing this year, that people are stealing packages off your front porch, watching for deliveries to be made, and just going around and picking them up and getting whatever's inside. And so that's something that you need to be on guard for as well, and definitely know when your packages are coming and get them inside in a reasonable time so that someone's not tempted to take that off your hands for you from your front porch. So, just a little warning there for this time of year.
Yeah, we do a couple things in that regard. When we use Amazon, there's a function, if you have the right garage door opener, where they can be given a code, a one-time code that they can put stuff inside your garage. And I feel more comfortable than that than leaving it out on the porch, although we live in a fine neighborhood. But not a bad idea. Keeps it out of the weather, that kind of stuff too. Another thing is, depending on what it is, have it delivered to work. Somebody is usually there, and I wouldn't go to great extremes here, but that is an option if it's certainly something of value. To deliver it to somebody or front desk where you know somebody's going to be there to receive it. Not a bad idea. So probably fewer porch pirates in your office, certainly in ours, than there are in your
True.
neighborhood. So
True. There are also those kiosk things now that you can have it
that's
delivered
right.
to,
That's
kind of
right.
generic, and you get a code to
I've
open
used that
your
before. It's pretty
cube.
cool. There isn't one super convenient to my home, but at the office there's one too. So
Cool.
yeah, they're kind of in out of the way places where you don't expect them, like next to a car wash or something like that. They're just wherever Amazon or whoever could find a willing plot of ground to put their stuff in.
Sure.
So, anything else in community news and
Interesting.
feedback, Sally?
One more thing to mention, and that's from teacher Kristen Nickelbein, who's at St. Mark. And I want to say it's in the La Crosse area, but I can't remember the exact town that Kristen's in. Anyway, she wrote and said, "Has anyone come across any information about how to deal with EANS funded devices when they need repair, replacement, or recycling? What are the expectations and protocols?" And she got me at EANS, Martin. I'm going to be honest, I didn't know what that was. I'm sure the techie teachers out there recognize it, but it's something that came out of the COVID pandemic, and it stands for Emergency Assistance to Non-Public Schools. So it's some of that federal money, I believe, that was distributed to schools as emergency dollars. And obviously, I'm sure had specific use cases and things like that, including some device purchases. So that's kind of where she's at. Some of those devices now need some attention, apparently. And she wondered if there were guidelines about that. I did a quick search and found absolutely nothing about what to do with it after you have it, only how to acquire those EANS funds and things is very specific. But yeah, I didn't find anything off the top of my search anyway. So hopefully someone out there has some experience and can share that with our WealthTech community. I will put a plug in to our WealthTech Google group, which is where she asked the question. You can join that group and have access to the techie minds of the Synod, where you can ask questions like this and get responses almost always. There's people that are willing to chime in and give you their experience and stuff. A really great place to be. And we'll have a link again in the show notes to the WealthTech Google group.
Kristen is at St. Mark in Eau Claire.
Eau
So right
Claire.
edge of the state, just wrong north south. So
Sure.
very good. Thank you, Kristen, for submitting that. Appreciate that. And hopefully you get some good responses too.
Yeah.
I think that does it for community news and feedback. As Sally mentioned, all the locations you can use to get in touch with us, and we would certainly welcome that. We are going to do our regular Christmas interview. We try and find a person or people sometimes from the Center for Mission and Ministry that we can interview around Christmas time about their use of technology and how their area uses it. And one big time user of technology is our Wells Benefit Plans office. They need to maintain, our healthcare stuff and our pension and defined contribution data, amongst many other things. And Josh Peterman is the director there, and he has agreed to join us and talk a little bit about what they do and how technology plays a role in their work for you. So tune in next time for that interview with Josh.
Looking forward to that. Great
I
guy.
am too, Sally, that's going to about do it. And we thank our listeners for, as usual, for tuning in. And we pray that you'll come back next time. And blessings on your Advent season. Talk to you soon. Bye bye.